everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. And the Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries around the world over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on trade secrets. That's those facts that you're not supposed to know right after this. You know, when the federal income tax was launched back in 1913, the tax was levied only on the super wealthy, the richest one-half of 1% of the population, with a top tax rate of only 7%. Today, of course, the fears of those early opponents of the tax have been more than fully realized. And by the end of Herbert Hoover's term, the top tax rate had jumped to 60%. By the time Franklin D. Roosevelt was done, the top tax rate was over 90%, and the tax had been dramatically expanded to seize the incomes of the middle class for the first time. Now, in 1913, the average family had to work until January 30th to earn enough to satisfy the tax man. This year, the average American family had to work through May 12th in order to earn enough to pay their federal, state, and local tax bills. Now, when you compare this to the plight of medieval serfs, says economist Daniel J. Mitchell, he said they only had to give the lord of the manor a third of their output, and they were considered slaves. Now, what does that make us today? This income tax and social security tax violate 3 of the 10 commandments and 8 statutes of the Old Covenant, including our English common law. And the income tax and social security tax are 2 criminal activities. The income tax is the 2nd plank to the Communist Manifesto, and Social Security is the 8th plank. Now, that's why I contend that you owe it to yourself to at least ask this question: do I really want to participate in this kind of criminal activity? Now, if you'd like more information about tax and status, call us here at the law school. The number is 417-273-4967. Be sure to ask for our free general law CD package while you're at it. Remember that 4-hour commentary on the law school is entertaining, educational, it's informative, best of all, it's free. That number again, 417-273-4967. Now, tax and status, the school is available on compact disc for adult home education. And if you're online, you can go to our website, georgegordon.org. Just click on to the email and send us an email request for that free general law CD package. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Well, last time we were talking to Tom Collins. He's a druggist, a real live, honest-to-God legal druggist who works in the local Rexall store. And we're looking for trade secrets, you know, the facts that you're not supposed to know. And one of the last things he said, about 58 minutes and 10 seconds, was this thing of how are drugs tested for the marketplace? And he got started on that, and that came off because we're running out of time. So I said, hey, stick around, let's do another hour. Tell us the story, Tom, about how these drugs are approved or how they're tested to get them out there in the marketplace for you and me to take.
Well, a drug company will get an idea, like they want some kind of drug for, you know, Parkinson's disease or something like that. So they'll come up with a molecule, and then they'll put it into a pill form or some kind of formulation. And then the first thing they need to do is to test the toxicity of the drug. That's the first thing they need to do. So the first test that they perform is called the LD99, lethal dose 99. The lethal dose that it takes to kill 99% of the mice that they feed it to. That gives them an idea of how toxic the drug is. And then they back it off to the LD50, which is lethal dose in 50% of the mice. And then they have a gauge of how much it'll take to kill all those. And then they back it off until it's they can get a what they would call like a safe dose of the drug. That's the first, that's phase one. And the phase two is you're going to start testing it in humans. So what they'll do is they'll start testing the safety in humans. They'll give them different doses. It'll take a thousand healthy volunteers between, I think it was the ages of 18 and 40. They'll give them these drugs and they'll say, well, what's it do? What kind of effect does it do? And they'll test it like that and they'll see how what kind of side effects they're experiencing. And then the next phase is the phase three trials, where they actually will test it in human subjects for the indications of the drug. If it's arthritis, if it's high blood pressure, something like that, then they'll test it in those human subjects. And then phase four is when they finally release the drug, they get it approved by the FDA. They have all these clinical drug trials, and the FDA will approve it, and they'll put it out in the market, and then the population that's supposed to be used in will start using the drug.
How do we know if the drug works?
Well, the people that they tested in during phase three, some of them will receive the real drug, some of them will receive placebo, and they'll see how it compares, whether or not it's better than placebo, and that's how they come up. They use their drug trials as the main gauge as to how it's working. The Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act, I think it was back in the 60s, I forget what the act was called, but they had to prove safety and efficacy. So you have to make sure that it's safe and that it works. And the safety is proven through the drug trials with the mice, and they just want to make sure it doesn't kill anybody. And they find out the dose that you can use in humans, and they find out if it works. But a lot of these drugs in practice, there's a couple of drugs that they use for Alzheimer's disease and Parkinson's disease. As they're put out in the marketplace, in real practice, in real life, I know just from my experience, I don't see that they work very well at all. I see they make a lot of money for the companies that are putting them out. I don't see that they work very well for the population that they're used in.
So let's take Merck or Pfizer. They know that they'll make a lot of money if they've got a lot of people that are sick with Parkinson's or Lou Gehrig's disease or whatever it happens to be. So they just start putting some chemicals and molecules together and test them on rats and mice and see if it does anything to alleviate Parkinson's in rats and mice or whatever. And then they go through this four-step process and they get it approved and they get it out in the marketplace. Now, in the case of Vioxx, later on, or Tambacol or whatever you call
Tambacor.
It. Tambacor. They found out after it got out in the human population that it killed 50,000 people. How come they didn't find that before it was released?
When 3M went into the business, they wanted to get into the drug business. 3M makes tape and different things like that. They wanted to get into the... It was a burgeoning market. It was this antiarrhythmic market because there were Ingelheim, Boehringer, and there was another company that had a couple of burgeoning antiarrhythmics, and 3M said, oh, we want to get into the business. So when Tambacor came out, they said, well, we can only use this in a population of someone only as a drug of last resort. And they wanted it as a black box warning. 3M went to the FDA and said, look, they said, if we have this, if we put this, release this drug with a black box warning, we're not going to get the sales that we want. So in order for us to get it prescribed, we've got to take that black box warning. As soon as they took the black box warning off, the doctors just assumed that it was safe for the general population, for the general antiarrhythmic population, and prescribed it as such. They were supposed to look and read that it was only as drug of last resort. They were supposed to read this information. They were supposed to get forward the full disclosure, but they didn't. They didn't, and then, of course, these people died as a result. They didn't do a post-marketing drug trial to see if these people were living until I think after the drug had been on the market for 5 years, they didn't even know if it was working correctly, because the antiarrhythmic, when it was put on the market, it was a theoretical. It was a theory that if you gave someone an antiarrhythmic drug, that it would stop your heart from going into arrhythmia. It was a theory. It was never tested. It was never proven. But they just got the drug. They got the drug on the market. They proved that it was safe and effective in a very small population. And all the information was in the package insert. But it was buried in deep inside the side effects that the doctor would not normally look to see if it was something you would use as a first-line therapy as opposed to a last-line therapy. Now, after all that went down, Tambacore wasn't taken off the market. It just got the black box warning that it should have gotten from the beginning.
So it's still available?
Still available.
So I can get Tambacore?
You can get Tambacore.
Killed 50,000 people.
Killed more, maybe more.
And it's still on the market?
Yes.
But now, the black box warning, what is that?
That means as soon as you look at the package, as soon as you look at the bottle, they'll have a package insert. And as soon as you open it up, it's a big black box that says, warning, only to be used in the event of life-threatening arrhythmias. That's it. The first thing that you see, you don't even see the drug names. The first thing that you see is a huge warning right on the front of the package insert, right there. Boldface, and it needs to be. And I think maybe it has information on the bottle that says, please see package insert for special warnings.
So this wasn't on that back in the 80s.
No.
And so that's why it got out there in the general population, and millions of people are taking it.
Right.
And then, well, that's not bad. Millions of people are taking it, and only 50,000 died. But 50,000 was too many, wasn't it?
Yeah.
What's the acceptable number of people that die from a drug?
You know, I don't know. I don't know what the acceptable amount of people that dies. It is a low percentage. I mean, if you were to take it, if you want to take it as a percentage, it is a pretty low percentage of the people that do take the drug. But I think the numbers speak for themselves. If you're getting 50,000 people that die over the course of 8 or 9, or 10 years, that's only 5,000 a year. I don't know what the acceptable level is. For me personally, I never really even thought about it like that. What is an acceptable level of humans to die?
Well, 50,000 people dying in the 10-year war in Vietnam was unacceptable.
Right, right.
And that was about 5,000 a year. But evidently 130,000 people a year that die because we need good medicine in this country must be an acceptable level.
Yes. That's right.
So my guess is that Americans are prepared to sacrifice 130,000, maybe a quarter of a million, in the name of good medicine because of these drugs, and it doesn't seem to bother them.
Mm-hmm.
But I saw the other day in the paper that E. coli had somehow gotten into the spinach supply, and as a result of that, one person died. And it's in the news. It's on the news. It's on CNN. It's in the 6 o'clock news. It's in the newspapers. It's in the news magazines. Evidently, E. coli in the spinach is unacceptable because it killed one person.
That's right.
But 130,000 people that die every year in and year out, is acceptable. And that's why I ask you, well, is there an official acceptable level of death that the FDA puts out,
no,
or the drug companies put out, and say, well, if it kills 5,000, so be it.
Well, let's put it this way. If you have someone that died and it was from a side effect of the drug, and they received full disclosure and they understood the possibility, the dangers of these drugs, then everything was done in all the right manners, and everything was done properly. And it's the person's, you want to get down to brass tacks, it's the person's fault for taking the drug. They took it, they knew the warnings, they knew the dangers, they knew the possibilities. And that's it, and it's on them.
Okay. How do you know that I know and have full disclosure? Do you tell me when you're a druggist, now when I come in and I take Tambacore, do you say, oh my God, this is black box drug, Are you on your deathbed, Mr. Gordon, and this is a drug of last resort? Did your doctor explain that to you? Do you tell me that?
I would tell you that you need to take it twice a day, that you're going to take it with food, and that if you see any exacerbations in your heart condition, that you should immediately call your doctor or run to the emergency room.
But you're not going to tell me about this black box?
No.
Is there a law that requires you to tell me about this black box?
No. I'll tell you the most common side effects. And what they say in what they said in pharmacy school, I said, well, how many, what side effects should you tell people? And they said, I said, should I tell them that there's a chance that they can get, that they can commit suicide because they take Prozac? No, don't tell them that, because that is a very remote chance, and they probably won't, that they may, that's very upsetting information, and they shouldn't hear that. So it's kind of like, you're almost treating these people like infants. Like, you don't want to give them any information that's going to upset them, you know, or anything like that. Just give them the most common side effects, that what they can expect, what they'll see, and then they'll say, oh, wow, we can really trust you because you're our pharmacist.
So you wouldn't want to tell me anything that might upset me.
If I were to say to you, sir, if you take this drug, you can die. You will die faster than if you stop taking, than if you don't take this drug at all and don't take anything. You're going to run back and tell the doctor, and the doctor is going to call me and say, what the hell's the matter with you? I'm prescribing this drug, and I want this person on this damn drug. Don't tell him that this kind of information. He's fine on this drug. That's what they're going to say to me. And when these kinds of reports come out about this kind of stuff that happens, these antiarrhythmic drugs that haven't been proven to prevent arrhythmias, the first thing that you see in an article in the newspaper is, do not stop taking this drug. Continue to take this drug upon the advice of your doctor.
Yeah, excuse me, maybe I'm missing something here. Does the doctor tell you Tambacor is a black box drug and that it could kill you? Is there a law that requires him to inform me about the potential side effects of this drug? Because last time you told me they're using big words that we don't understand.
Yeah.
So if I read this article myself in this box, I probably wouldn't understand it. But I could understand a big black box, just like I could understand a skull and crossbones on a package that says poison.
The one thing I need to tell you is that each retail pharmacy that dispenses prescriptions, they get their money from dispensing the prescriptions. If we get a doctor that prescribes a lot of our medications pissed off because we keep telling our patients that the drugs that they're taking could kill them, we're going to lose business. The doctor's going to get upset. He's going to call the pharmacy, and he's going to bitch and complain to my manager, and we're going to lose business, and I'm going to lose my job.
But does the doctor have any duty to show me this black box warning?
No.
Do I get a black box warning in the package when you give it to me?
No.
So the black box warning is for doctors and pharmacists, but not for consumers.
It's discretionary. I can tell you it if I want to. If I think I should tell you, I will.
What if your customer asked you? I mean, you know, I've got listeners here that are listening to these revelations. And
mm-hmm.
So what should we do when we come into the drugstore? Should we ask the druggist,
is this
drug safe, or is this drug a black box last line prescription?
If I was going to look, if I sized up a customer and this person came to me, pulled me aside and said, look, I really don't want to take this. Can you be honest with me about this drug? I'd say, yeah, absolutely. I would be honest with them about this drug. But the average guy that's going to walk into the pharmacy, he doesn't know, doesn't want to know, and doesn't care.
So if you want to know, and if you do care, then you should ask the pharmacist, hey, level with me, I really don't want to take this drug. What's this drug going to do?
If I get a person that has, if I have an ear of a person like that, I'm going to tell them. This isn't the same situation, but I had a lady that came in with her husband, and she was looking at some of the vitamin supplements. She says, my doctor says I should take 1,500 milligrams of calcium a day. She says, can you recommend anything? And I looked at her, and I said, how old are you? And she says, I'm 50. And I said, he told you need to take calcium? And I said, yeah. I said, have you ever taken calcium before? She says, no. I said, then you don't need to take calcium now. I said, because the time for you to start taking calcium is when you are about 20 years old. And I said, and for him to tell you he's taking to take calcium now, I said, it's useless. I said, it's not going to do anything. I said, if you have osteoporosis, I said, if you have bone problems or anything like that, there's nothing that taking 1,500 milligrams of calcium a day is going to help prevent. And I could kind of look at the lady, and I could tell that she was skeptical and asking me, honestly, what I thought of it, because I wasn't just going to reach over the counter and volunteer that information. And she took it to heart. I didn't sell the over-the-counter prescription. She walked out empty-handed. But I told her the information honestly. So I am required to offer counseling. I'm required to give them the information on the drug. Am I required to tell them there's a black box warning? No, as long as I make the information available. And I say, well, this is for use for cardiac arrhythmias. And then they say, if they were to say, well, how dangerous, if they were to start probing about how dangerous the drug is, and I'd say, oh, it could kill you.
Tom, last time you said that you wouldn't take these drugs yourself.
Not at all. No, I would never take these drugs.
Can you tell us why? Are these drugs safe?
No, they're all dangerous. All of them are dangerous, from aspirin to codeine.
Oh, come on. Aspirin. It's got to be the safest drug out there.
It's been on the market for over 120 years or something like that.
What's dangerous about aspirin?
Well, if you're an older person and you take, some older folks like to take aspirin for aches and pains, or sometimes the doctors say, well, take an aspirin a day for your heart condition. Some of them take it more. They'll take one for their heart condition, or they'll take it every 6 hours if they're having joint pain. If they bump into a table, if you cut yourself, it's a blood thinning agent, anticoagulant. You bump into a table, you can cause. I've seen people with these bruises, and I say, oh my God, what happened to you? And they say, oh, I bumped into a table. I say, how hard did you bump in? They said, not that hard, but I bruise easily because I'm on aspirin. And you'll see this huge black and blue spot. Oh, if you hit the wrong spot, you can bleed internally, and you won't even know it. And you can hemorrhage and can cause serious complications, even if you cut yourself. If you get a small cut and you cut yourself, you can bleed out pretty well. It can kill you. The aspirin can kill you if you don't use it correctly, and especially with the older geriatric population. Sometimes they can't feel, their fingers or their toes and stuff. They can't feel this if they bump into something, or if they're bleeding, or if they're they're hemorrhaging. They really don't know. It's the same thing with Tylenol. Doctors talk about how safe Tylenol is. Tylenol is safer than aspirin because it doesn't cause stomach upset. You won't get the they say, well, you don't get the bleeding problems. You don't get the interactions. The problem with Tylenol is the maximum dose they say per day is 4 grams. Pills come in 325 or 500 milligrams. And if you're an older person, older people take Tylenol. I'm young. I could probably take more than 4 grams of Tylenol, no problem, at one shot. Every day, your liver gets rid of it. It gets hung up in the liver. Well, if I took that every day, every single day, like a lot of these senior citizens do, well, I'm going to start compromising my liver function. And especially with the older population, you get a 75, 80-year-old person, their liver's been working every day for their whole life, and they're taking four grams of Tylenol all day. They can precipitate liver failure.
So the guy dies of liver failure. Now let's see, he's in a nursing home. He's taking all this Tylenol, and it's given to him by the nurse because he's got arthritis, and he suffers from liver failure, and it kills him. On his death certificate, it says he died of liver failure, not Tylenol poisoning.
They may determine that it was caused by the Tylenol. But it'll probably have on there they died of liver failure.
Well, are you telling us then that drugs aren't safe?
They're not safe.
Even aspirin, Tylenol, ibuprofen, all these drugs that they're advertising here, you know, on the 6 o'clock news.
Sudafed.
You know. All these drugs have a potential for killing us or harming us.
If you have high blood pressure and you go take your over-the-counter Sudafed is a vasoconstrictor, meaning it constricts the blood vessels. You take too much Sudafed, you die of a heart attack. And if you have high blood pressure and you take Sudafed and you die of a heart attack, well, you had high blood pressure.
So we would expect somebody with high blood pressure to have a heart attack.
Yes.
So it was exacerbated by the Sudafed, but who's going to ask the question?
They're probably not going to test. They'd have to do a toxicology report. They'd have to test it. But if you're 60 years old, you've had high blood pressure for a long time, and then you die of a heart attack, they just put two and two together.
Okay, now doctors are trained to prescribe medicines,
yes.
Aren't they?
Yes.
They go to medical school. Do they know this?
No. Well, they'll learn it in their training. They'll go to school. They'll learn how to diagnose conditions, but they're not taught about the drug interactions. They're taught one semester of pharmacology. They have several years of school, and one half year is all the prescribing that they need to do. They may be taught some interactions, some drug interactions, probably very few, but they're taught how to prescribe. They're taught that semester is used on how to prescribe. We have how many years of pharmacology? I think I had 2 years. 2 years of pharmacology plus all the other training that I had in medicine. And we're the ones that dispense. We're not allowed to prescribe. If you actually want to get to be technical, the pharmacist knows more about the prescribing of medications than the doctors do. The doctors ought to be spending most of their time, this is just my political argument here, most of their time diagnosing conditions and then hand over the diagnosis to the pharmacist and say, what medication should this person be on? And then we would prescribe. But it doesn't work like that. The doctors prescribe, they diagnose and prescribe. And then we spend, 10-15% of the time saying, no, this is the wrong dose. This is the wrong medicine. You shouldn't be using this. Why are you using two of these? You shouldn't be. And then the doctor comes back and says, oh, that's what I want. Then we can't do anything about it.
So as a pharmacist, now trained in these drugs and drug interactions, do you ever get prescriptions that come across and you look at that prescription and say, oh, my God, this is wrong. This is bad.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. What do you do when a case like that comes
up? Got to call the doctor immediately. Say we can't do this. There's a really severe drug interaction, or it's the wrong dose, or it's too high of a dose. The doctor could come back and say, well, I understand that. I understand that, but this is what I want. This is what we need to do, and then that's it.
So then you cover your high knee by calling the doctor and saying,
right.
Hey, this is the wrong stuff. If he says, okay, let's change it. Fine, but if he doesn't, then you just go ahead and mix it up and give it to... Now, do you have a duty to tell this lady, no, listen, I talked to your doctor, and he's prescribing way too much of this, and it could kill you?
We don't have a duty to tell them, because they already have the prescription. It's already there. No, we don't have to. If he or she asks, I'll tell them. I'll say, this is just what I do. A lot of the pharmacists don't like to raise the alarm bell. Again, it goes back to this. Well, what do we really want to tell these people? That's what we talked about pharmacy school. Well, how much is too much information? We talked about that. And a lot of the pharmacists would say that this is too much information. George, if I were to talk about all the side effects of all these drugs to these customers that come in, they'd walk out empty-handed. They wouldn't want to be on this crap. And I have talked about some of the stuff to some of the customers that come in, and a lot of them don't really see why they should be on the drugs, but they take them anyway because this is what the doctor prescribed. And they say, well, this is, I understand, thanks for telling me, but...
The doctor must know best.
That's right.
So they just treat medical patients like children.
Yeah, that's right.
It's a guardian ward relationship.
That's exactly right. and they treat me the same way, they will, you know, they'll ask me questions. They'll ask me questions about certain things, and if I say it's good, they say, "Oh, well, that's great. You know, that's great. I'm glad you told me. Thank you so much." And then they, you know, they call you for everything. You know, and that's right. I feel like I'm. Sometimes I feel like I'm talking to children.
Clean drugs versus dirty drugs. Tell us about this. Let me describe this to you. The other day, we enacted this Medicare program for the elderly. And you can buy drugs out of Canada cheaper than you can buy them here in the United States. And so it's very common. People in Vermont will drive across the border into Canada, pick up their drugs, and come back home. Well, the other day, Congress enacted legislation to ban that. And the guys behind that was, well, we don't know what kind of drugs we're getting, and they might be dirty drugs, and they might be bad drugs, or they're not consistent with the formulations that we have here in the United States, casting dispersion, of course, upon Canada or France or England. And, you know, right away I said to myself, excuse me, if I was buying drugs from Bangladesh or from Nigeria, I might listen to that argument. But it seems like to me that Canada or England or France or Germany are just as technologically advanced and can produce clean drugs as the United States. And it just looks like to me to be a political sidestepping of pricing. Of
it is.
Drugs. Now, they tell us about clean drugs and dirty drugs, and they say, well, these drugs you buy on the street are dirty drugs. Tell us about clean and dirty drugs, would you?
Well, I mean, the difference between heroin you get on the street and morphine in the drugstore, there really isn't much of a difference, you know? A junkie doesn't care if he's injecting morphine or heroin. He's not going to inject himself with dirty morphine. He's not going to just take the heroin and just draw it up in a syringe and inject it. He's going to freebase it. He's going to boil it out, try to get it as clean as he can, and inject it.
Excuse me. Wait. Is that what freebasing is?
Yes. You free the base from the chemical. When they boil it in the spoon, they'll get the flame under the spoon. They'll boil it off the base.
Yeah, I saw it in the movies. I know how to do that. I saw it in the movies. Like the guy, he takes it. So what he's doing is the pure drug is mixed up in this bad stuff. So by putting heat under it, he frees this base, all this impurities.
Yes.
He gets the pure heroin, the pure morphine, and then he injects that.
That's right.
So that's pretty clean stuff.
Yeah, it's pretty clean. As long as if he used a clean needle every time, and he wouldn't get he wouldn't get AIDS, or he wouldn't get hepatitis or anything like that. So he's not out. I mean, I'm not. You know, obviously, I'm not promoting illegal drug use, but he's going to try to look out for his own welfare. He's going to try to make sure that he's not poisoning himself. I mean, sometimes they OD, or sometimes they do inject themselves with impurities, but by and large, it's relatively clean stuff.
All right, now, what about this stuff that you get in the drugstore? The stuff that you're selling to us over the counter, is it freebase too?
You would need to freebase it. You would need to get the if you were going to use the powder formulation or some of the pills, you would definitely need to free the base.
Oh my God! Wait a minute. Hang on a second. Are you telling me that the drug addict on the street over here is injecting cleaner heroin than you're selling me across the counter?
Well, the pharmaceutical companies, they get the purest form of morphine or of any of these other drugs, and if they're going to put them in a pill form, they need to add different ingredients to it, and it's the same thing with the heroin, with powdered heroin. It's in a form that has a certain base that for the processing of it. So when you process these pills, it's going to have a certain base to it. Injectable liquid morphine. You can get it. It's used in the nursing homes all the time. You could use that as preservative free, but you're still going to have preservatives in a lot of this stuff.
Kind of like thimerosal and
yeah.
Vaccines.
Exactly.
So the vaccines aren't pure.
No.
They've got these additives in it, and it's the additives that are killing us.
Yeah, that's exactly right. That's right. It's not necessarily the drug itself. It's some of the additives that are in the drug that cause those kinds of problems.
So the drugs that you buy on the street, for all practical purposes, are just as clean as the drugs, and maybe even cleaner than the drugs you buy at Rexall.
Yeah.
That's the reality of it. Oh,
yeah.
My God. Hang on, boys and girls, stand by. We've got to give you a reminder. We're at the halfway point. We're talking about trade secrets, and tonight's trade secrets, facts that you're not supposed to know about the pharmaceutical industry and the pills and the drugs that you're ingesting every day. Let me remind you that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide, over the Internet. For more information about The Law School and The Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. The Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. Now, the law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults and compact disc. For more information, please go to our homeschooling page on the website at georgegordon.org. Remember, the Law Hour website is updated every week. It has a radio log schedule and archives, and it can be accessed through the webpage. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Remember, the Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events. And we do that 7 days a week. The Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the Law School at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief, and the Law Hour and editorial review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program, and we often endorse and recommend books, periodicals, papers, and newsletters to our listeners. Now, the endorsements or recommendations that we give do not mean that those authors or publications that we endorse or recommend are going to reciprocate. And that's because most of these authors and publications that we cite here on the Law Hour are political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint is not necessarily 100% endorsed by the Law Hour and editorial review. Now, the opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone, and they don't necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of our advertisers or our sponsors, management, or staff of this network or a local radio station. Now, for more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, remember our website is georgegordon.org, or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. Now, tonight we're talking about pharmacies and the pharmacological industry. Trade secrets, facts that you're not supposed to know. But I wanted to give you the address here, name and address, and the title of a book that I've been reviewing this week. It comes out of the boardroom. It's called Boardroom, B-O-A-R-D-R-O-O-M, Incorporated. All rights reserved, copyright 1996. I picked up this copy at I believe it was Barnes & Noble. And you can probably get it at Amazon.com or just order it from your local bookstore. Just remember, Boardrooms Incorporated. And it's just loaded with little trade secrets that deal with things like safety and computers and diet and nutrition and medical, your car, you know, your finances and the IRS and credit and insurance and on it goes. So I thought, well, I'm going to ad lib. I happen to have a student here by the name of Tom Collins, and Tom was good enough to spend an hour or two with us here in the studio this afternoon. I started picking his brain and said, my God, I've got to get this. I've got to get this on CD, Tom. And he said, okay, well, I'll tell you what I know. He's a pretty straightforward kind of guy. He's just telling us this is where it's at. I went to drug school. You know, I went to pharmacy school. And these are the little trade secrets that you and I aren't supposed to know. Trade secrets like, oh my God, we don't want to upset the customer. Well, would you like to be upset by being told that this drug could kill you? God, I would want to be upset. I would want to know that this drug is called a black box drug. So now let's ask that question again. Tell us, Tom, what are the levels of warnings that are in these drugs, black box being the top of the line? This is the one that can kill you. What are the other warnings?
Well, you have your general precautions in the drugs, that you shouldn't take it with you know, drug X or drug Y causes these drug interactions. Black box warnings are usually on drugs after an incident has happened. Usually what they do is, there was a drug called, the generic name is called salmeterol. It's a long-acting inhaled drug used for asthma. When I remember when this first came out, I said, oh no, what people are going to do is they're going to use this in place of, there's another drug used for, it's called a rescue inhaler, called albuterol. And I said, oh no, these people are going to use it the same way they're going to use albuterol. And it's extended released inhaled formulation. That's exactly what happened. These people started using this when they would start going into asthma, having asthma attacks, and then the salmeterol inhaler didn't help them. They died. They would start dying. They didn't put the black box warning on it until after these people had died. And they said, "Now it's a black box warning. Warning: you cannot use this to rescue yourself from an asthma attack. You have to use your regular albuterol inhaler." So it's not really set in stone when you should have a black box warning. It's usually for drugs which have extraordinarily bad things that can happen or have happened to them. There's an injectable drug that you have to give it. As soon as the bottle is open, you have to use it because it can grow bacteria inside the bottle. And of course, if you inject that into yourself, you'll die because you'll get a blood infection and you'll die. Big black box warning says that. It's usually used in hospitals. And this Tampacor is another drug. It's just after the accident happened, they put the black box warning on this. So it's not really set in stone. You have your precautions. You have your warnings inside of the package insert. But only special circumstances will take place where they decide that this warning is what they need to put on the package.
If I ask the druggist at Walmart, you know, I walk in and say, "Hey, listen, would you level with me and tell me whether this drug is good or bad?" Think he'd do that?
The average guy's going to toe the line. The average guy's not going to be as candid as I am. They're going to want to keep their boss happy, keep the doctors happy. Because you know what people will usually do. They'll go run back to their doctor and say, "Oh, do you know what the pharmacist told me? You know what the pharmacist mm-hmm. told me?" I had a lady one time. I was working in a home infusion for a home infusion company. She was on this drug called intravenous immune globulin. It's for your immune system. And I called her. I was doing a drug assessment, and I asked her. I said, do you have the symptoms? And I was going through all this stuff. I was going through this assessment, and I said, and she was telling me all this information. It didn't sound right. And I said, why are you on this drug? And she says, "I really don't know." And I said, "Well, your doctor says your immune system is down." And she says, "Yeah." And I said, "Well, it sounds like it's not working." And she says, "Yeah." She was an older woman. She went back and told the doctor that I said that it wasn't working. And then he called me and started complaining to me, bitching to me on the phone, that why are you telling this lady that this is not working, and I'm prescribing the medications here. And I said, "Hey, doc," I said, I just came to an assessment. I said, it was just based on what I was hearing and what she was telling me. And I said, it didn't sound like it was working. So, he never called my boss, but I'll tell you what, I'll bet if he did call my boss, this guy prescribed a lot of medications, my boss probably would have bitched me out.
So what we're really after, what we're really trying to do here is to sell product.
Yeah.
And we really don't care about whether it's safe. And
that's
we really don't care about whether it works. We're here to sell it, and it makes you feel good. And if you're not complaining about it, and you buy it and you pay for it, that's all we're really concerned about.
We had a guy who came in this retail pharmacy. Him and his whole family were on Medicaid. And they got about 30 prescriptions a month. The guy was always came in, there was something wrong with him. He was always really disturbed. And he would always yell and scream when he came up to the counter. And then the head pharmacist said to me, he says, "This guy is a cash cow for this pharmacy. Please don't upset the apple cart with him." I wanted to call the cops on him, but they just said, "Look, you know, we really need to. He'll take his business elsewhere if he needs to."
Yeah, it's like a drunk in a bar,
George. Honestly, I thought that this guy was going to fly over the counter at me and he was going to hit me. And then the other pharmacist says, "You know, we really can't. We really got to keep this guy calm. We can't really do anything because he's there. The family they bring in a lot of business."
So you wouldn't want to tell this guy, "Hey, listen, you know, these drugs that you're on are bad for you."
Couldn't care less.
He just wants to get his drugs, and they're being paid for at taxpayer
expense.
That's
right.
So you said there aren't any safe drugs. Let's talk about that a little bit further. Because all of us presume that drugs are safe.
Yes.
I mean, I just can't imagine aspirin being dangerous or Tylenol being dangerous. But from what you're telling me here, it's rare, but it could, the aspirin or the Tylenol, could kill us if we take too much of it.
That's right. That's right.
This Tambacor over here, Vioxx, is one that was just taken off the market. The other day I heard there was a drug, flutamide, I believe it is.
Uh-huh. Flutamide, yeah.
Caused birth defects.
Yes.
It's still on the market.
Still on the market.
Used for something else other than...
Yes. Yeah, it's not used for... I think they were using it for anxiety before pregnancy, and it caused birth defects. Now, it's under name. The name of the drug is called Thalamid, and they have...
Changed the name.
Well, it is thalidomide. You know it's thalidomide. The brand name is Thalamid, and it has these huge... Actually, it's kind of a disturbing package because it has all these pictures of these deformed children that were as a result of this thalidomide. And we have a registry. The doctor has to sign up with a registry. These patients need to be registered, so it's highly controlled. And of course, you know, if you're pregnant, you can't be on it. But it's still on the market. It was off the market for a long time. They put it back on the market about seven or 8 years ago.
So this is a deadly, dangerous drug.
Costs about $400 a month. Yeah,
but it's worth $400
a month. $400
a month.
Yeah,
that's what you guys in the trade call a cash cow.
Yeah, that's right.
And so if a pregnant woman came in, gave you the prescription, said, "I want to buy this," you'd stop her, wouldn't you?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Because that's against the law for you to sell it to
a
pregnant woman. But you can sell it to men and boys and women and old people and young people and for whatever it's prescribed for. And it's $400 a month and it makes money. And,
and
you're happy with that.
Right. Right.
All right. Now, are there any other dangerous drugs that are commonly used that we ought to know about?
Sudafed.
Sudafed?
Sudafed.
That's an over-the-counter drug.
Yeah.
I mean, I just buy that at Walmart, can't I?
Uh-huh.
And that's dangerous.
That's dangerous.
What's dangerous about it?
If you have high blood pressure and you take Sudafed, you go and it's over the counter, so you normally wouldn't ask a pharmacist something about, you don't need a prescription for it. And you have high blood pressure and you take Sudafed, there's a possibility that you can exacerbate your heart condition, you can die of a heart attack.
And Sudafed, is that for colds and flus and things like that?
Yeah, and it's in about, I don't know, 100 different over-the-counter products. If you go to Walmart or you go to one of these other big pharmacies.
Is this the stuff that they use for methamphetamine?
Yeah, it's the active ingredient, methamphetamines.
Okay. Now, this methamphetamine, we were talking once before, Tom, and you mentioned that... the pharmaceutical salesmen, when they come in, they guard the prices with their lives.
Yeah.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but this Sudafed comes from India, doesn't it?
Yes.
Three big manufacturers in India make Sudafed for $1,200 a ton.
Right.
And ship it to the United States. And then they manufacture Sudafed and a number of other drugs out of this, whatever they call this chemical. Now, I worked that out the other day, and it looks like it's about 6 cents a pound.
Yes. And they sell it for in...
Or $6 a pound, I forget exactly, but...
They'll sell it. Each tablet, the low strength is 30 milligrams, the high strength is 60 milligrams, and they'll sell them in boxes of about, I think it's like 24 tablets.
Let me just divide that out with my trusty Texas Instruments calculator here. $1,200 divided by 2,000 pounds is 6. So do we get 6 pounds for a dollar? No. That's not right. If I had 2,000 pounds and I divided that by $1,200, it'd be $1.66 a pound. All right, I'm spending $1.66 a pound. And when you sell this stuff in the capsule form, we're not talking about pounds or even ounces.
Milligrams.
We're talking about, let's see now if we can understand this, an ounce. We can get an ounce. An ounce, there's 16 ounces to a pound, and there's 31 grams to an ounce. And when you sell this stuff, a milligram is a thousandth of an ounce, isn't it?
Of a gram.
Well, that's a thousandth of a gram, and there's 31 of these grams.
Yes.
Okay. So if it's $1.66 a pound, we divide that by 16, and then it's 0.10 cents per ounce. Now, that's a penny an ounce. Am I right? Or is that 10 cents an ounce? No, it's 10 cents an ounce.
Okay.
So it's 10 cents an ounce. Now, there's 31 grams in an ounce. Let's see if I can get this one. 31 grams divided by... 10 cents for an ounce. That looks like we're getting about 3 grams for a penny, isn't it?
Uh-huh.
Okay. Now, you're not even selling the stuff by the gram, are you?
Uh-uh. So, milligrams.
So I get 3 grams for a penny, and now you got to break this gram down into milligrams.
So you got 60 milligrams times 24 pills. So... how many grams is that in a package?
60 times 24 is 1,440. So we're only getting about 1.5 grams, which didn't even cost a penny.
Right.
Okay, now what does that sell for in your drugstore?
The cheap stuff will go for like $3. $3 a package.
So a product that you walk into the drugstore and you pay $3 for cost you 1.5 cents.
Right.
Okay. Now the drug companies guard this information with their lives.
Right.
Okay. I don't know what the percentage of markup is. That's higher mathematics at this point in time. We'd almost need a mathematician.
Right.
But let's see now for our listeners. Let's see if we can understand this. You spend 1.5 cents and buy this stuff in India. Bring it over here. And then go to work on it and put it into pill form, and you sell it for $3.
Right.
Okay. That's a hefty markup.
Yeah, it is. It is.
That's better than jewelry.
Yeah.
That's better than banking.
Yeah.
Insurance.
Uh huh.
Yeah. Is there a better program that you've ever heard of than pharmacies?
No.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Nope.
Okay, better than banking, better than insurance. Excuse me, it's much better than selling cocaine out on the street corner.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Very high profit margin. I had a lady that came in once. She had a generic prescription. It was a prescription for it was a cough preparation in tablet form. And my boss told me, he said, if you have a cash paying patient, customer, he says, you could take the average wholesale price, the price that you buy it for, and he says, and just add a few bucks on there. He says, just as long as we don't lose any money off of it. So I had this huge bottle, so like 1,000 of them or something like that, and there was a sticker on there, We bought the bottle. I remember this. We bought the bottle for five. It's like, yeah, I'd say it was like $5 for 1,000 of these babies. We were selling them for the entire bottle. I think the price was over $100. And I remember telling her, she was kind of a funny lady. I said, look at the price on this. And I said, you have 60 pills. And I was looking at the price. I said, that's going to cost you a dollar or something. And she says, how come so little? And I said, because you're paying cash. I said, we're going to charge the insurance company a lot more if you had an insurance. I said, but you're paying cash. And I said, look how much we buy this stuff for. And it was like, I couldn't believe that we spent so little for a generic cough preparation.
You spend, you buy a gallon of this generic cough preparation for $5. And then you turn around and you sell this product here for how much?
It was like $100. Actually, there are pills. They're pills, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay, you buy this bottle for $5.
Uh-huh.
And you sell each one of these bottles that come out of this big bottle for $100 each?
No, it would be, the whole bottle could be unloaded for $100. But what they would charge is, they would probably charge, I think it was like 20 bucks for the prescription, something like that, the insurance company.
So the insurance company, if you're talking about buying insurance, you really sock it to the insurance companies, but for cash customers that come in, you give them a good deal.
I would. Yeah, I did. Yeah.
Do most pharmacies work that way?
No. No. I did it because she was, my boss told me I could do stuff because it was an area that they had a lot of cash paying patients, mm-hmm. and we worked deals like that. I just did it because I just thought that was probably the right thing to do.
Is there any skimming going on in the drugstores?
No, there's no skimming like that. I know that we overcharge.
You overcharge, but you pay full tax.
Yes, that's right. Okay. That's right.
Well, with the kind of money that you make, I guess you can afford to pay the tax.
Yeah, that's right.
So it's good for government,
mm-hmm.
and it's good for the pharmaceutical industry, good for medicine, good for you. Hey, I'm almost out of time. I got to ask the question. How much do pharmacists get paid?
About 90, average about $90,000 a year.
So as a pharmacist, you're up around the top 5% of income earners in the country.
Yeah.
That's pretty good.
Yeah, we do pretty good.
Yeah, you do pretty good. And the markup's pretty good.
Yeah, the markup's
And the product you sell, you say, is so bad that you wouldn't use it yourself.
I would never touch it.
Oh, my God. Here you are making $100,000 a year off of the general public over here selling a product that you yourself wouldn't ingest.
That's the price of good health.
That's the price of good health. My God. Thank you so much, Tom.
Thanks for having me, George.
All right, let me give you a final reminder here. I'm just about out of time here, but I wanted to tell you about this book. It's called Trade Secrets, and that's what we've been talking about this week, are the trade secrets that you're not supposed to know, facts that are supposed to be kept top secret. For more of those, go to Boardrooms Incorporated. Now, you'll have to buy the book called Trade Secrets, Facts You're Not Supposed to Know at Barnes & Noble. But the outfit that puts it out is called Boardrooms. That's all there is to it, just Boardrooms Incorporated. All right. Hey, listen, let me give you a final reminder here. You've been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Remember, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide over the Internet. If you'd like more information about the law school and The Law Hour, then please go to our website. It's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals by prearrangement. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. Remember, the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. There, time's up. You've got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station. God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.